very brief article that I read this week caught my attention. Here's what it said. It's called The Right Call. The author says, you don't find too many middle-aged men petitioning the Marines for a long stay at Paris Island. It's young men who beg for that kind of rigor. The spiritual writer John Hugo told a cautionary tale. Youth leaders face the country depressed and dejected from its defeat in war. They seemed aimless, with little hope for professional opportunity and no clear sense of patriotism or other ideals. The clergy made a conscious effort to accentuate the positive. They decided to accommodate the country's weakness, avoid mentioning sacrifice, downplay the cross, and other negative elements of Christianity. They were big on nature hikes. At the same time, there arose a man who called upon those same youth to give up everything for the sake of their country. Quote, he put them in uniforms, housed them in barracks. In short, he demanded that they live a hard and laborious life, unquote, Hugo said. Adolf Hitler won the hearts of the youth. Because no young man or woman wants to give his life away cheaply, but they may give their lives to the wrong man if no one calls them to serve the right one. I thought about that as I was studying for this particular lesson today. In Luke chapter 4, verses 23 through 30, Jesus brings up two stories from the Old Testament. One of them was read this morning. We're going to get to the other in just a moment. But he challenges his hometown's lack of faith. Perhaps he assumes that this is the one challenge they need to drag themselves out of the kind of spiritual doldrums, if in fact it was a kind of spiritual doldrums. We know it was faithlessness that Jesus criticizes them for. He challenges the lack of faith demonstrated by his hometown. He was saying only what was obvious and historically true. The prophetic activity of both Elijah and Elisha occurred during a long period of faithlessness among the chosen people. And I appreciated Wayne's comments this morning, because sometimes faith is difficult to maintain when we experience difficulty. Maybe we lose heart. Maybe things kind of get us down. We kind of don't see perhaps what we're supposed to see. But I'd like to think that all of us are like the people that the Hebrew writer is addressing in Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 39. He says, I don't think you're the kind of people that lose heart and shrink back, or lose faith and shrink back. Don't think that's who we are. I'd like to think that's not who each one of you is not individually. And so I want to kind of address this from the standpoint of these several stories that we learn about that Jesus mentions in Luke chapter 4, Naaman the Syrian for one, but also this widow in a town called Zarephath. It's in a foreign country, foreign to the Israelites. It's in the region of Sidon. And it's an interesting story. We can find it in 1 Kings chapter 17, verses 8 through 16. And I want to kind of approach it by just sort of giving you some visuals to think about as we go through talking about this story. I have up here, first of all, some olive oil. I don't know if most of us use that in our bread. We probably use something that isn't quite as strong tasting. But it's olive oil. It's supposed to be one of the better oils for you as we keep learning more and more about health and the kind of things we're supposed to eat. Also has some flour. Yes, that's a big container. We like to make bread in my house, so I like to keep a lot of it around. That actually can hold about 10 pounds worth of flour. But flour and oil are two of the sort of things that are involved in this particular story. As we read about Elijah and his travels and his basically kind of running away in some ways and hiding. The story is this. Elijah has prayed to the Lord that it would not rain. In fact, he said to the Israelites, it will not rain in Israel except at my command. That sounds pretty arrogant. And yet he knows he's God's servant. Well, one of the problems when it doesn't rain is there's no food. And so Elijah himself kind of maybe wondering how he's going to be fed. He runs away to one place, and we read the story about how the ravens bring him bread and he has some water, and the ravens bring him meat, and he has kind of enough to eat at this point. The brook runs dry where he's staying, and so now he's got to go somewhere else. God tells him to go up to this town called Zarephath. And he goes up there to live out the famine, 3 years worth of no rain. And you think about that. We've had a couple of periods here the last few years where maybe we've had about 2 months worth of no rain. And it gets pretty dry pretty quickly. Not much grows. The grass grows brown, which is generally fine for me because I don't like to cut it anyway. But you really don't want it to stay that way for very long. And so he goes there to live out this famine. And he approaches this woman who is a widow. She has a son. And he says, bring me something to eat. She says, all I got is a little bit left, you know, and my son and I, we're going to make this meal and that's going to be the end of it for us because everything's going to be gone at that point. Elijah says, go make me something to eat and don't worry about the rest. And so what happens is every day the woman gets up, she finds that there's enough oil and enough flour for her to make bread for herself and her family. We're not told where the oil and the flour comes from. It is obviously a miraculous thing that God is doing for Elijah and for this widow to keep them alive. And it just, the next, each day. I'm sure she doesn't stand there and watch and go, okay, there wasn't any left. Oh, gee, look at that. It's growing on me. And all of a sudden, there's more there. Somehow, probably unseen, she just gets up and, it's the same as it was yesterday. So I guess I'll just make some more flour. She makes some bread, and the next day, bingo, it's back again. God provided for Elijah, the widow, and her son. No particular reason is given for his journey to this woman's house, to this region, other than the fact over in chapter 18 and verse 10, when Elijah finally reveals himself, or he begins to reveal himself, we learn that the king has sent emissaries to all different places around them to find where Elijah is because he feels like Elijah is the troublemaker and he wants to kill Elijah. Perhaps God sent Elijah to this one place where he would have never thought of looking. In fact, Elijah never gets found until he shows up one day. Israel was in a state of faithlessness. In such a state of faithlessness that God sends Elijah to a foreign nation, to this off the way, this out of the way place, so that he can survive this famine. It was a sad fact that Israel had fallen prey to idolatry so much. The famine was a major crisis. It was a direct result of their idolatry, of their rejection of God. Though they had somehow maintained all the Baal worships, and if you remember what happens to Elijah on Mount Carmel, he says to the people of Israel, bring all the priests of Baal. Remember how many there were? There was 400 of them. 400 prophets of Baal were left. There wasn't any prophets of the Lord other than those 100 or so that were being hidden, kept away from Jezebel because she was trying to kill all the prophets of the Lord. But even after Elijah's great victory on Mount Carmel, they continue with their idolatries, all the way into the time of Elisha the prophet. And that's where we pick up with this second story that we have. Story of Naaman the Syrian. Again, another foreigner, another one that Jesus uses these two stories in his discussion in the beginning of his ministry in Luke chapter 4. Now, Naaman's case is rather interesting because Naaman has a skin disease. And I just have here today some skincare products. Quite a small representation of the numbers of skincare products that we have. But our skin's kind of an interesting thing in a lot of ways. And it's funny how many things we can get dirt on our hands and we just wash it off and it's fine. Certain chemicals we can put on our hands, if we were to ingest them, it would kill us or make us very sick. And I wouldn't recommend doing that, by the way. But our skin is kind of our one of our first lines of defense against the outside world. And, you know, one of the problems that when people have serious burns is the fact you tend to burn away, you know, a certain layer of your skin, and it leaves you vulnerable to infection. So our skin's a pretty amazing thing. Now, Naaman had this disease, a skin disease called leprosy. Now, whether or not he would have been able to use some sort of cleansing cream or like I have here, some sort of night cream, or even when you have a cut or a sore, we have triple antibiotic ointment that you put on the cut because you want to keep, you know, a cut is the way that infections get into you. So you want to keep it clean. I have something here. It's called the cortisone cream. I have a condition that I get occasionally. It's called seborrhea, and it's just it's a reddening of the skin. It gets raw, and it feels like somebody just kind of scraped my forehead with sandpaper. Gets a little flaky, and I put some of this on. Within a day or two, it's gone. Okay, just something that kind of comes and goes. I have to take care of that. You have your own personal skincare products that you like, but you want to take care of your skin because it's important. Leprosy was one that was incurable. I believe today we have some medications that people use, but it's generally incurable. And you have to stay away from other people because it's extremely contagious. Other people can get it from you very, very easily. And here was this man who was a commander of an army, of a Syrian army, of a foreign army, of one of Israel's enemies. And he is told by a slave girl, why don't you go to the land of Israel? There's a prophet of God there. And you know what? He can heal you. So any of us who had any kind of chronic illness, anything that kind of is recurring, you'll do almost anything to get relief from it, won't you? Even go to a foreign country, perhaps. And he takes a rather large troop of people with him, and he goes down there, and he gets to hear at least from Elisha. And what Elisha does, I just want you to go wash in the Jordan. You got to dip 7 times, but I want you to just go wash in the Jordan. And he's kind of livid about that. Wow, I mean, I'm a commander of an army. You know, why can't he tell me to do something great? I can perform, you know, deeds of bravery, and I can do great things. And I'm a very important man. What is he doing? Tell me just to go wash in this dirty old river. We got better rivers back where I'm from. And some of his servants have to say, Naaman, if he asked you to do something great, wouldn't you do it? Well, yeah, I guess so. Well, how much more? Just go wash and be clean. And indeed, Naaman goes to the Jordan River, he dips himself 7 times, and he comes out clean. As healthy, it says, as a child's skin. His skin is perfect. Would you like to have perfect skin? Again, skin like you had when you were a child. Naaman proves to be a very willing convert, because he goes back to Elisha. And when he goes back to him, and this is verses 15 and 5, a little bit further on in the story than what was read this morning, he wants to do several things. Number one, he wants to give some gifts to Elijah, who refuses them. When he refuses them, Naaman says, well, let me take back some soil from this place, because he has this sort of notion that a lot of the people would have had in those days that each god was sort of a local deity. And he had to be worshipped in different locales, required a sort of different god to be worshipped and a different way of worshipping them. So he wants some of this soil because he thinks that's, you know, very much attached to the notion of the Lord, the God that has now healed him. So he says, okay, go ahead. If you want to do that, that's fine. He's not trying to make him an Israelite, interestingly enough. But, you know, now Naaman knows who the real God is. He's had an experience. So whether he has this kind of mistaken notion of how to worship him, he still wants to worship him alone. And he also says to Elisha, look, I got one other thing I need to mention to you, because when I go back, there are times I have to go worship in this pagan temple with my chief, with my king. And when I bow my head in worship on my king's arm, please forgive me for that. He says, go in peace. So Naaman has something happen to him that just changes his life. I keep mentioning Luke chapter 4, and if you turn to Luke chapter 4, you'll see that in Luke chapter 4, when Jesus begins his ministry, he actually starts in his hometown, and he talks about the scripture that they just read is going to be fulfilled right now in their hearing, and that is, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he anointed me to preach good news to the poor, etc., etc. And they just kind of don't get it yet. So Jesus takes these two stories about the widow of Zarephath and Naaman the Syrian, and he says, look, even back in Israel's day, God sent these people back to this to people who weren't of the people of Israel. Because the people of Israel had no faith, and they did. They believed when they saw these things happen. And so Jesus challenges them to think, you know what? You got to come up with something a little better than what you had here because your faith is non-existent. It's not working for you. He invites them to believe. He challenges them, perhaps. Their faith, for some reason, is blocked. Maybe it's blocked because of what sometimes happened to people, and that maybe it's kind of blocked by a sort of familiarity. You know, you kind of get used to seeing things in a certain way, and you can't sort of step outside your own little box and see things a little differently. C.S. Lewis calls it the overlookability of God. I know that's not a word, but it sounds pretty good. The overlookability of God. He says, his book called Miracles, he makes this statement. The fact which is in one respect the most obvious and primary fact, and through which alone you have access to all other facts, may be precisely the one that is most easily forgotten. Forgotten not because it is so remote or abstruse, but because it is so near and so obvious. And that is exactly how the supernatural has been forgotten. Maybe that's how we forget God. We sometimes forget the ever-present nature of God in everything. And maybe sometimes we, as people of faith, we kind of get so familiar with our own faith, we forget, you know, for one reason or another. Maybe it's fear. Maybe we're just afraid of the way things are going, and we just kind of forget faith. You know, Satan does a pretty good job of throwing up a lot of things at us that might cause us to lose our faith, or might cause us to doubt, or might cause us to just be afraid and not realize what he's trying to do. Or maybe it is that we look at what Jesus is doing and go, whew, that's a little bit more than I bargained for. It's interesting, as we follow Jesus through the Gospel of Luke, by the time we get past Luke chapter 4 into Luke chapter 9, it says in Luke chapter 9 and verse 51, when the days drew near for him to be taken up, he set his face to go to Jerusalem. And Luke makes a big point of the fact that Jesus is on his way to Jerusalem, and he's on his way to Jerusalem because we know later on he's going there because he's going to be killed. He's going to experience the cross. And he keeps trying to tell his disciples about this. And he keeps talking in this same section. Read later on today, verses 57 through 62, where he talks about how costly it sometimes is to follow him. And suddenly we begin to start looking at the cost, and we go, well, I don't know if that's what I bargained for or not, or what I really want. But the fact is, Jesus is formulating some challenge of following him. And rather than look at it as sort of a negative thing, maybe we need to look at it in the same way that in our story about the call, we need it as something that, you know what, here's something worth the challenge of discipleship. We need to feel challenged by it in a way that, rather than help us lose our faith or be fearful, say, you know what, we really need that kind of thing because this is really something worth following. And Jesus, we'll find out, will conclude his work by suffering and dying. Just before that happens, we get to Luke chapter 19, verses 28 through 40, the other passage that was read for us this morning. This is interesting in a number of ways, not the least of which is Jesus' ministry is coming to a conclusion. But the fact is, one of the things that has happened here, and if you follow through the Gospel of Mark, it becomes even more clear what has actually happened here. All the way through Mark seems to bring this out more than the others. Every time somebody is healed, Jesus says to them, don't say anything about it. either go home and rejoice or go back to the priest and offer the sacrifice or go offer an offer of thanksgiving. Something like that, he'll say to them. But he said, I don't want you to go and blab it about. What happens here in Luke chapter 19, this triumphal entry into Jerusalem, now all of a sudden his idea is, you know what? Let's let it all out. The disciples just praise his coming. As he enters Jerusalem, it is like a commanding general coming in now, conquering, a conquering commanding general coming into his city. He hasn't quite conquered yet, but he's going to. And so indeed it is a triumphal entry. It's an unlikely scenario here. It's spontaneous. It's unplanned, at least on the part of the people. And it gets everybody's attention. Jesus allows them to announce His coming. His detractors resent it, and His followers love it. Were they to be silenced, Jesus says in verse 40, and I've always found this to be one of the more fascinating statements that Jesus makes. He says, were they to be silenced, the natural world itself would announce His coming. He says, these stones would cry out. That presents to us the cosmic dimensions of just what's happening here. God is involved, and isn't anybody going to stop Him? Because if you try to stop Him, nature itself, God's very creation, is going to cry out. And He's going to cry out. I'm guessing this is even a little different than the metaphor we get in Psalm 19, where the heavens declare the glory of God. Here, I'm guessing they really would have spoke. Something would have announced His coming. Some way the stones and the natural order itself would have let everybody know that what's happening here is happening because of God. This is a call worth following. Because God is at work. It is, in fact, a call to be involved in something absolutely extraordinary. God is about to do great things. But if I understand Luke 4 correctly, He won't act on our unbelief. I think this is the message when Jesus brings up this notion of the widow of Zarephath and of Naaman the Syrian. He's letting us know that, you know, we got to at least come to grips with being able to say, I'm going to believe this. Elton Trueblood differentiates between believing that something is true and believing in it. For the latter, when we believe in something, our entire self is involved. We've put ourselves at stake here. What we are, what we do, is really so much involved in this. It's just what we want to be involved in. It's no easy matter to commit ourselves to such a degree. And there are a lot of things that try to drag our attention away. Flannery O'Connor, the author, writes or suggests that at some point we have to grow past this simple childlike faith that merely accepts everything to realize that faith is sometimes costly. It's not a big electric blanket, she says. It's a cross. But you see, the very fact that it's costly is like the guys that want to go to boot camp to be a Marine, because being a Marine is something special. Nobody likes going through what you have to go through, but the fact that you can go through it and endure it and come out on the other side, that's a great thing. It's a thing that God is doing for us. It's a thing that God has in fact done through Jesus Christ. In Luke chapter 9, Jesus is headed to that cross. In Luke chapter 19, He's about to go through it within a few days. But you see, Jesus wants nothing short of our full allegiance. When He demands faith, that's really kind of what He's talking about. Don't allow those things that cause you to be fearful, that cause you to be too familiar, whatever it might be, don't allow those things to get in the way. What God is calling us to is something great. Doesn't always come easy. It isn't for those merely looking for the most comfortable seat on the bus. Faith is a divine call to participate in a divine plan. It will demand the best we can muster and will often involve us in difficult things. Yet the promise of a great kingdom, isn't that what drives us on? That promise of a kingdom, that hope that Not only has God done something, but He's going to do something for us as participants in it. He's allowed us to be a part of the kingdom. And we're going to be in a kingdom at some point that's never going to end. Not going to end in death. Not going to have the struggles and hatred and violence and things that are going on in this life. Keep the faith. God isn't through until Christ comes back again. Accept the challenge as a challenge to something great, not as a negative thing to keep you from doing something great.